Hello and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadmore, and with me as always is Thomas Brooks.
Hello, hello.
So we're finally going to talk about something that we don't have to give a disclaimer and say, well, we are social psychologists. And so
we're playing on the home turf tonight.
Yeah, we're going to talk about social psychology. And very specifically, we're going to talk about identity. It's kind of part of our wheelhouse. We study identity in a number of contexts between fan identity, gender and sexuality identity, identity aspects of identity, variations of identity.
And the identity aspects of the variations of identity. Quick question before we get started. Would you say that psychology is your most dominant salient identity?
Ooh, I don't know. Maybe not.
No?
It's probably up there.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, there are a lot of different types of psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I don't know, after 10 years of school, probably, it's probably a 7 out of 7. But there are probably other things that I also give, like, a 7 out of 7 on a strongly agree Likert scale for. There's not a lot. Maybe not as much as there would have been, like, 10, 15 years ago when I really started studying this. There are a lot of fan communities I don't belong to.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't consider myself, like, highly identified. Like, if they ended tomorrow, I could just move on with my life. Because I also have other identities to fall back on.
Right. So good, healthy rounding out of several strong identities.
Yeah, I mean, psychologist is up there, but I like to do a lot of cross-disciplinary research. And so, you know, I've published in communications journals. I'm looking at some, like, anthropological, sociological stuff. I've done evolutionary research in the past. And so I've dabbled in enough, you know, things where I don't necessarily feel, like, too grounded. Like, if someone told me I needed to leave social psychology tomorrow, I'd be like, all right, I could probably go find a niche in this other field of psychology.
Mm-hmm. No, that's fair.
I'll go into fan studies and communications.
Right.
Do qualitative analysis for the rest of my life.
Oh. No, I was about to say that I could probably switch over to higher ed research pretty easily, but then I would also be doing a lot of qualitative research for the rest of my life.
Or you do the quantitative research in there, and at least some people in those fields would really appreciate it.
They do, actually. No, there is value in the quant in higher ed.
And then the other ones will tell you that you're garbage and that your sample size is terrible, even though they don't do quantitative analysis. So,
likely I'll get accused of, like, not having the full richness of the data.
Yeah,
because it's all numbers.
And there's a huge identity aspect in that, like the field that you're in, what you learn. These are the norms of the community, and you follow the norms more closely to those communities that you highly identify with.
Hmm. I will say there are two distinct subcategories in psychology that I've noticed on the Twitter machine that are kind of outside discipline specificity. It is the R psychologists and the open access psychologists.
So, like,
and they tend to be the same group.
The ones who use stats R?
Yeah. R programmer, like, they are quite diligent in their evangelizing of that statistical software.
They highly identify with their statistical package.
And same goes for the open access ones, too. I mean, I appreciate both. I think they're both right. But
yeah,
that group is very salient.
Yeah, and so I guess we could start by kind of identifying what this is. What do we mean by identity? And we are going to talk a little differently. There's some great research on, like, self-identity out there. There's some really amazing research that kind of, like, falls in line of how we view kind of ourselves and kind of the self individual aspects, those personal aspects of identity, which do play a role in this. But we tend to study a lot of social identity, and so the group that we belong to. So there is an overlap, yourself and your group do overlap with one another. But it's definitely tied to how much do they overlap, to what extent do those two circles cover each other, and the more they do, we'd see that the more you're going to view your group as more diverse because you have more interaction with your group, you're going to follow group norms more because you know the rules of your group as opposed to others, and a number of other factors that kind of fall under the line of social identity. So most of this research comes out of the work of Henry Tajfel. So Tajfel and Turner, 1979 is the big publication, and then John Turner would go on to publish research on self-categorization theory, which kind of expands on this and deals with more salient group identities. So what group are you thinking of yourself? And then we'll kind of talk about these as we go through and some of these sort of aspects. So last episode, we mentioned personality as an identity. Mm-hmm. But these group identities can go further. I mean, anything that you can tie into aspects of who you are. So your star sign, as we talked about last time, can be an aspect of identity. I think Thomas maybe identify a little more as a Virgo than I do as a Sagittarius.
Mm-hmm. But I was able to pin you as a Sagittarius, so somebody who's at least aware of their description.
I'm really not. That's the thing. I know that I am one because of when my birthday is.
Mm-hmm.
But like, that's the extent of it. It's definitely not something that I'm salient of enough to know like what it's supposed to be or like what my horoscope says it's supposed to be. But if that was something that I kept up with, I probably would be salient enough in it. It probably would influence some aspects of how I view myself based on that group identity. You know, much in the same way of now knowing that I'm an architect and one of the two superior MBTI categories.
We are the best ones.
That you know, if I really internalize that, or if I really, you know, like, I'd argue even if I didn't buy into it, just like that knowledge that I belong to this category can have some influence on how I might view myself in situations where it is made salient, where I am made sort of aware of my membership in those groups.
Right. Yeah. No, because even if you look at some of the work of our advisor, Stephen Risen, one of his favorite methodologies is to split up the participants into American and college student and just remind them that they're either American or college student. And that's all he does at the beginning of the survey. And then you see drastic changes in the way that those participants behave. So we don't even really have to like internalize the idea that we're American or college students or whatever, you know, Sagittarius or INTJ, but just being aware, if it's in the forefront of your brain, like your whole perception kind of shifts a little bit.
Right. Right. And that can go along with any identity. And so these include identities that you have chosen to belong to, or that over time you have kind of understood that, yes, I belong to this group. And it was a very self-reflective process, versus identities you have no choice to be a part of, that other people have placed upon you, that we identify. What is the, Kay Doe did a bunch of research. He's done a bunch on like the social categories and like kind of the core categories that we tend to find ourselves in. So they include things like obviously vocations and avocations are two of them. So your jobs and hobbies. Above those are things like political and religious identity. So those tend to be pretty big, especially in the United States. And then also like the stigmatized communities that we belong to. They're not maybe as high as some other ones, but hey, even if we don't want to, people are likely to remind us, hey, you belong to this group.
Right. It's going to be the identities that you rub up against most frequently.
Right. And there's some interesting stuff. We'll put a link to this Google Doc for this great handout. But there's some great information here, especially it looks at like how people react to those identities, what happens when your social identities are threatened. And it kind of touches upon the basics of social identity theory and then how we categorize ourselves, these categories, self-categorization theory, these categories that we belong to. But there are other researchers. So we look at people like Kay Doe, who's done a lot on these different categories that we belong to, and how we define ourselves based on them and how they influence our identity in a number of ways. Also people like some other big names are like Michael Hogg. We'll talk about him in a little bit. He's done a lot of research on it's called identity uncertainty theory, and many, many, many others. And so, yeah, so like basically the idea, if we're talking about personality and if we put this into terms like outside of, let's say, the MBTI and say, all right, are you an introvert or an extrovert? And then I ask you on a scale of 1 to 7, 1 being strongly disagree, 7 being strongly agree, or yeah, how would you answer, I strongly identify as a introvert or an extrovert? I feel
Definitely probably like a 5 or 6 on the introvert. I tried to buy a car today and I interacted with too many humans and now I'm horribly sleepy.
Yeah, there's part of me that maybe, again, if you would ask me like 10 years ago, I'd probably say, I think I still identify more as an introvert in the grand scheme of things. I am perfectly comfortable being at home alone. I am perfectly comfortable not having to call someone on the phone. I will email someone if I have to, but I am happy,
every time
happy not to. But I have to do it for my job, and also I have to get up in front of a classroom of people multiple times a week and lecture.
Yeah,
I do.
Why did I choose that profession?
I do feel socially winded, by the end of my day, especially on a long multiple class day. But I really enjoy doing it. And so like that gets into that complexity that like no one's a true introvert or an extrovert, because we do have introverted people who will happily do extroverted things. I will get up in front of a classroom of 100 people and give a lecture or a speech. And when I started teaching, it's almost 11 years now, 11 years ago, I was a nervous wreck. It was a miserable semester, but like over time I was like, oh, this isn't so bad.
Yeah, no, and then one of the things, so when this is something that I came across when I was studying the Jung types, was that the conception of the introvert and the extrovert is that like the extrovert gains energy in social situation and the introvert expends energy in social situations, and that's not necessarily the way that we conceptualize them now. Even though like psychology still uses these terms, so now it's understood that there is a like tolerance threshold for social situations, and so for introverts that threshold is much lower than for people who identify as extroverts. And so the ability to go out and lecture, you know, you have the energy to do the thing, but you may be more winded afterwards than say the extrovert is.
I'm not going to be pumped up and ready to like then go to the bar afterwards.
Right, I'm going home after that.
Yeah, there's not to get too neuroscience-y in our social psych discussion, but there is some optimal arousal research in terms of introverts and extroverts that might work to explain that extroverts maybe, at least like the current trending hypothesis, is that extroverts kind of wake up at a lower optimal level and need to raise it, whereas introverts wake up above that optimal level and need to drop it. And so trying to balance that. So it kind of gets into what Jung suggested.
We have these
different levels and this need to either, you know, take in more energy or get rid of some of that energy. And so, you know, sitting by yourself in the morning, reading the news, having a cup of coffee might help you reduce some of that and kind of get you down to a lower level. And that's my go-to in the morning. And then I can go out and I can go teach class.
Same.
So,
but no, I have to. I'm trying to get into the mood of like waking up super early because I know it's going to take me a 1 to 2 hour buffer before I'm actually ready to be a human after I arise from the dead. So,
yeah, I had a student email me first thing this morning. It was like, can we meet? I know it's like 8 a.m. and I was like, okay,
no. Oh.
That's technically when my day starts, because I have a class at 9 and I'm usually doing like all the stuff at 8 to prep. And I was like, all right, like I might as well wake up now. I was up.
Nope.
But like part of the issue with this though is if you highly identify, how that can affect you then. And so if I'm not only identifying as an introvert, but I'm also pulling in all the stereotypes, the prototypes,
you know, right.
What is the average introvert to me? Possible exemplars. And so exemplars, these are individuals who kind of exemplify, represent whatever group that we belong to. So a really good example, and we'll talk about politics a little later, is the president tends to be the exemplar for their political party. They are a representation.
Right.
Whether people in the party want it or not, whether you have groups like the Lincoln Project saying, this isn't our Republican Party, it is. That's your leader.
It definitely is.
Who the people voted for. And the same thing for anyone in the Democratic Party. If they say that, you know, Biden's not their guy, he is. He is the exemplar.
Is.
The nominee is typically the exemplar, the leader of the party. The CEO can be the exemplar of a company. So if Tesla decided they wanted to distance themselves from Elon Musk, good luck. He is running their company. So they can't do it. He is their exemplar of what, you know, if you're a billionaire and you wanted to distance yourself from someone like Jeff Bezos, good luck. He is the exemplar.
Right. And there's like the subjectivity to the exemplar too. So kind of going back to our introvert extrovert example, you're not going to be like, oh, I'm an introvert because I have this like upper lower threshold of energy.
No.
You're like, oh, here are these people on Tumblr who talk about being introverted, and I'm going to amalgamate all of their ideas into myself, because we're talking about a group identity in this situation. So you have to look at the other people around you and what kind of behaviors they exhibit, whether or not they're actual introverts, whether there's some social anxiety going on there, whether or not they're, you know, what is it? Misanthropists?
Yeah.
Like people haters, like, I hate the human race. So you're going to start pulling all those little characteristics into your introvert identity. You're not going to be basing it off of like the neuroscience journal article you read last week.
Right, because the average person is more likely to engage with someone who talks about how they're such an introvert, and then you look at their other tweets or you look at their other blog posts or whatever it may be. And the downside to that is that if you kind of do take that as fact, you may not experience some level of social anxiety. You may not experience actual like clinical levels of anxiety until you start highly identifying as such. And then you kind of maybe view that as a perfectly normal behavior for someone in your group. And it can become maladaptive. I mean, the flip side of that can also be true. If you say, like, I'm an extrovert, and extroverts are always going out and partying, well, like, that can become maladaptive. Like, going out and having a good time every now and then is fine, but hey, moderation and everything. And so, you know, if you're at the bar every night, because that's what extroverts are supposed to do. I mean, not you know, you can look at the multitude of reasons why people might, but if it's because that's what extroverts might do, and these other people I follow who prop themselves up as extroverts, or, you know, kind of look at that extrovert-introvert divide, or maybe you're just seeing those introverted people like, I'm not like them, I'm an extrovert, so I have to do the opposite in the extreme.
And typically these are not conscious decisions that we're making either.
No.
This isn't something where you sit down and take a tally and go, oh, hey, these are the qualities I need to start embodying. It's like, oh, I don't necessarily feel like an introvert, but this is what introversion is. And then you start slowly shifting your behavior that way. A really good example of kind of this maladaptiveness. Are you familiar with the empaths?
I know what the word means, and I can probably take a good guess at who these people are. But go ahead, identify.
So the empaths,
define it.
The empaths are a group. They're very new agey. They identify with the ability to feel other people's feelings. And a part of that identity is this quality where they don't have a boundary line between themselves and another person's emotional state. And so they just take on all of these like parasocial feelings, like high theory of mind stuff going on, just fully unadulterated theory of mind going on. And so their group dynamic is this expectation that you need to lower your personal boundaries and start taking on the emotions of other people at all times.
Ooh.
Yeah. Ooh.
Because, I mean, again, kind of gets into that same analogy with like the introvert. Like, it's perfectly fine to be an introvert. It's perfectly fine to be a high identifying introvert. But there's this difference between almost internalizing the stereotypes of an
Yeah,
introvert. Because,
introverting your way to agoraphobia.
yeah, like, empathy is great. We should all empathize. We should all experience empathy throughout our day, throughout our lives. But like completely breaking down those barriers can be very,
Troubling.
yes,
That's a chaotic life you're living there.
and very stressful for the person involved. I mean, I can only imagine what it's like to just completely not be able to, like, I mean, there are times where, you know, I can just, you know, imagine like reading through a student email, trying to empathize with their problems and the stresses that they're going through. And I'll do that to an extent. I'm not too far out to forgetting what it's like to be a student. But also, like, I can't completely give in to those feelings because otherwise, like, I wouldn't sleep. It's maybe why I didn't want to become a clinical psychologist, because you have to be able to steel yourself at points, because you're gonna be exposed to some really difficult stuff at times. And if you can't sometimes put up those barriers, it's very difficult.
Yeah, you have to be able to take off the clinical psychology hat at the end of the day if you want a functional life outside of your job.
Yeah, just because,
And
yeah.
so that is kind of one of these examples of your identity. Like, not to pull a slippery slope argument here, but when it comes to identity, if you start like getting deeper into your group, you're going to start exhibiting more and more of the qualities of the group. And you better like double check if you're choosing this identity. So like make sure you know what's inside that group before you dive in.
And as we may touch on too, I mean, this like ties into how we're marketed to, that your identities and these groups that you belong to are targeted in a lot of different ways. They're trying to get you to view their product in terms of something that your identity or people who share your identity utilize. Things with parasocial relationships, we've talked about that with YouTube before. Go back to that old episode. Where, you know, again, that feeling of like, ooh, like I have to do what they're doing and I have to buy the same products that they're doing. And that's something that I've stopped myself and gone like, am I interested in buying this because it's tied to this one person? Or am I interested in buying this because of like something else? Like maybe I just enjoy it. Maybe I think it's funny. Maybe, you know, it'd be different too if it were like, oh, maybe some of these proceeds go to charity. So like I have an alternative reason to be like, I want to support this for these other reasons in addition to this. But also like making sure that you keep yourself in check, because you can then find yourself suddenly liking a lot of stuff and suddenly getting involved in a lot of stuff that may not have necessarily at least been on your mind. It kind of subtly works its way in.
Right. I think the first thought that came into my head when you were talking about that was Funko Pops.
Yeah, I have not. I do know some people who have gotten into Funko Pops. I have not gotten into Funko Pops, and
Like
I
they're in the
am.
background of, your gamer live stream at all times. You see them everywhere. They probably get algorithmically targeted towards you because you watch specific YouTubers or you go onto specific websites. I never get advertisements for Funko Pops, although watch, I'm going to get them after this, just because I'm talking
I
about
don't think I've ever gotten advertisements for them, but I almost wonder if like you don't need to advertise those.
Yeah, because they're already in, they're free, there's free advertising in everyone's video.
Yeah, they're in the consciousness. They're in the yeah, and so but like these are just ways in which the height, the level of our identity is likely to kind of move us towards the norms of whatever we identify with. And we can identify as, we do a lot of research with fan identity. And so those fan communities can revolve around a particular personality or something, some general larger sphere. But the more you identify with those groups, the more you're going to be picking up on what the rules of those groups are, because you're engaged with them more. You're invested in them. So you know what those rules are. Those rules are more salient to you. And thus, those are how you act, or how you behave.
And
And
it's,
that's.
kind of on purpose when you start tying product to those identities too. That's something that we were talking about in a separate conversation, that you were coming across a lot of research from the marketing business area on fandom.
A ridiculous, like I said, I've probably read in between 1,000 to 2,000 articles, or at least like reviewed the abstracts and got into the basics of, I mean, you've done the same recently,
mm-hmm.
this project. And yeah, there's an insane amount on just how to market to these groups and how to use aspects of membership in these groups. They're not typically written from a psychological standpoint. They do pull in some psychology,
mm-hmm.
but it's definitely if you can get these high identifiers, if you can get these like super fans, they're prime real estate,
mm-hmm.
because they're going to follow the teams. They're, you know, for sport fans, they're going to be buying the season tickets. They're going to be buying the merchandise, and the same for any other group of fan. And you know, that's where the money is.
Yeah. And oftentimes we see this in the research, is that a lot of times the commodity based fandoms will gatekeep who's a real fan versus who's not a real fan by the things that you purchase.
Yeah.
So if you haven't bought the latest edition, blah, 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 you're not a real fan.
I got snapped out of aspects of that real quick. I remember going to one of the first for the Brony, the My Little Pony fan communities, going to one of their first conferences to talk research and stuff like that. And I went and sat in on the auction, and I watched someone drop a month's salary, my month's salary for them. It definitely wasn't on like a signed poster. And I was like,
whoa.
I was like, wow, I don't make, and it may have been more than that. I was like, I don't make this amount of money in like 2 or 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. You know what? I'm perfectly content not mm-hmm. being that involved. But like that realization, and that person very well may likely be seen as more of a fan than I ever would.
Mm-hmm. Or at least they'll feel more like a fan.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And that's part of that identity too. But I mean, that's something that goes kind of beyond just that identity of kind of your personal interaction with it, because you can have individuals who never need to buy anything
mm-hmm.
like a fan. But there are some groups that are far worse with that. I mean, that's one of the things that we notice with some of these fan communities, is that they're super open and welcoming. Like if you've got nothing, they're willing to let you in. But like, that's one of the norms of that particular community. And then
like
you go,
the furries. I would say the furries fall into that. Because like, you would think that the fursuiters would be like true fans, but they're really not. Like, generally, if you're an artist, that kind of gives you more cred in the community than anything.
Because you're serving the community as opposed
yeah.
to... And I think most people would understand, like, and so for any of our listeners who have no idea, it's only about 20% that actually do the full fursuits.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's because they're so expensive. And I think if like the price went down, there would probably be an expectation, but it's also not something that's mass marketed either. And so there's mm-hmm. this, it's a commodity within the community. And so if you can make those suits, or if you can buy those suits, you're respected. I mean, you're respected if you can make those suits, probably more so than anyone who buys them.
Mm-hmm.
But also like, that's not what the community's about. It's a part
right.
of it. But people can express themselves in other ways. If they could draw their characters, if they could purchase art of their characters, they can do other things. That's tapping into that community just as much as
mm-hmm.
the person who expresses their character through the suit, as opposed to the art. The Brony community were a lot like that. They're very open and welcoming. There's a lot of commodification.
Mm-hmm.
The fandom around a cartoon that's made to sell toys.
Right.
But that necessarily wasn't around at the beginning. There weren't toys, you know, for the show, and there weren't, especially nothing marketed towards the predominantly adult male fans of the show.
Right.
So there was more of a need of like, hey, we're just going to be a very inclusive group. And
mm-hmm.
obviously we find gatekeeping, and obviously we find elitism, and obviously we find a number of different things that are sort of tied to this in every community. But if the norms in general are not about that, and this again kind of gets into how the group influences the fan, it's something very different that Pat Edwards, who I started working with the Brony study on, eventually kind of branched off because he was interested in looking at other groups, and he went to look at League of Legends fans.
Oh, bless his heart.
And afterwards, I remember having a conversation with him, like, after the first study, and he was like, they are very different. I'm like, yeah, if your only understanding of fan psychology has been the bronies, and you walk into a League of Legends tournament, you're about to have the shock of your life.
Seriously.
That even the even the bronies at that, who were also identified as League of Legends fans, were like, don't
do it.
It's we're a terrible group of people when we're there. We're a very different group of people when our brony identity is salient. So.
Yep, nope. And that's kind of interesting to see, and I know we will probably have more talks about this, but kind of the difference between some of these, like, bottom-up fandoms, where the fans themselves create the content, versus, like, the top-down fandoms, where, like, there's a media piece or a company that, you know, dictates the norms of the fandom in terms of, like, who gets to be true fans or not, who gets to be closer to the core. So I'm thinking, like, you know, Star Wars, for example, is having a bit of an issue right now because the top-down approach is trying to expand the fan base. I mean, the consumer base.
Yes.
Outside of, you know, white dudes. Yep. And so, and the fans who are, you know, probably you think that they're bottom up are running into some issues there.
Yeah. Yes. Star Wars versus maybe Star Trek. And I mean, modern Star Trek's a little different, but original Star Trek, we could argue, was definitely a bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
Because there wasn't. It was the cusp of what we would consider modern fandom. So there was no such thing. I mean, there was fan fiction, but like not like we view it today.
Mm-hmm.
Until these predominantly middle-aged women got together and started writing Star Trek fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And the first convention, like the big conventions, there were conventions. They go back to, is it like Worldcon? Some of the oldest. There's some even older ones that kind of like pop up here and there. But these like big conventions, the way we view them today, a lot of these early fan communities were very bottom up because there wasn't anything. Like the furries are definitely a good example of a bottom up fandom. The first couple of years of the brony fandom is probably a really good example of a bottom up fandom because like the show's not really being marketed towards them. They're not really viewed as a commodity.
Consumer demographic.
Point. Yeah, yeah, definitely not a consumer demographic. And so, but on the other hand, like Star Wars, I mean, maybe what it was to start, because again, but then again, there were toys pretty early on with Star Wars. That was definitely.
It was very planned out, I feel like.
Yeah, or at least.
They knew what they were doing.
Well, watch there's a good Netflix show, The Toys That Made Us. They have a whole episode on Star Wars toys. And, not nearly as planned out
as oh, you would okay.
think. But there were definitely people who were like, hey, we can market this.
Mm-hmm. And it's definitely not like a G.I. Joe TV show or Transformers.
No.
That only exists to sell merchandise.
Right. Yeah. So those, if there's a thing, you know, the fan communities around those toy collectors is very much a top-down thing. Like, there's the thing, and then there are people who join the thing, you know, who collect the thing. A lot of maybe video game communities might tie into mm-hmm. this. And again, that could get even more nebulous depending on what video game we're talking about. Some are much more applicable to these broader fan communities than others. Some are going to involve more self-creation, especially right now with a really good example of like a bottom-up community would be the people who make, they call Kaizo Mario hacks. They hack and they create their own Mario games. They're usually very difficult, but this is something that, like, these are, like, long-term lovers of video games. They highly identify, like, with the games and, like, as part of their childhood, and even other things. They just identify with, like, the competition or the difficulty and the skill that are tied to it.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, they're creating, I mean, we talk about video games as work of art, like, works of art. These are amazingly mm-hmm. in-depth, hundreds of... usually one person like putting most of it together with other people helping, and it's a very good example of a bottom-up, like the community is working together on this. There are composers, there are people who are doing stuff, and they're typically doing it just as part of the community. It's a very communal effort as opposed to something that's a commodity. And this stuff is put online. It is free. Like, you can go and download the stuff and play it on your computer or on, you know, a little cart or something. If you've got that capability, that they're able to do that. And something like how they interact with their community and the norms and the rules of their community can be very different. But also how they view their... that aspect of their identity, that particular fan identity, is going to be very different than that person who is like just in it for the Mario game, like the mainstream Mario lore, mainstream Mario games that are just going to basically, they're going to view things a little differently. They're going to maybe approach those games, and maybe you're both,
right?
But how you interact with other fans and with the product is going to be very, very different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think similarly, you could say that like the Skyrim or the Elder Scrolls fans have kind of gotten out from underneath Bethesda quite intensely.
With like modding communities and stuff like
that. Yeah, there's modding communities. I've seen like YouTube movie makers where they like take the mods and turn the game into like a series. I've seen pornography. I've seen
it's very transformative, and like that might be part of that difference there of, are you just kind of sticking with what exists because that's going to be that very top down approach, or are you transforming it in some way? And for something like this, like Star Wars, it becomes kind of complex because there are the toys and there are the movies and there's the official stuff. There's a lot of transformation going on, and it kind of depends on maybe how identified are you, how invested are you, what part of the fan community are you in? A lot of these little aspects that we'll kind of maybe get into, like this fracturing of the community as a whole, which can become more of a problem if you have gatekeepers and very elitist fans who say, well, like, you're not a fan unless you've, you know, can quote the movies, or you're not a fan unless you've seen the entirety of the Clone Wars animated series and Rebels and The Mandalorian and all of the supplemental stuff. Wait, you haven't read the comic books? Oh, come on.
And I would say that, you know, like, Lucasfilms has a better like fist hold over their community, because even though there is creation going on, they do a very good job of profiting off of those different little areas of Star Wars fandom. Like, they've got their fingers in everything.
Yeah, definitely. Star Wars is interesting too, because when you go back to the, we're gonna get on fandom too much. Yeah, I gotta keep moving on.
Surprise, it's a fandom podcast.
Yeah. Later we'll do a fandom podcast. So we have these groups that we belong to. The more you identify with them, and then over time, the more you're engaged with them, the more you invest with them, the stronger that identity is gonna be. And so there's other aspects of psychology, investment models, models of motivation. So the more intrinsic versus extrinsic your motivation is. We also find that fans are motivated for dozens of different reasons, and depending on what motivates you can then also influence not only aspects of identity. So are you just in it for the group? Mm-hmm. Are you in it for the entertainment? Are you in it for the stress relief? Are you in it for anything else? Does it give you hope or meaning? Mm-hmm. And so the more those are kind of internal factors, so I would argue things like maybe cathartic escape to some degree becomes almost like a necessity for you, but definitely things like purpose, meaning, aspects of belonging, those are going to increase that group identity more than just something like entertainment alone. Like, I could sit down and watch an anime and just enjoy it.
Right.
But it's going to have to be some kind of special anime to make me a part of the anime fandom again.
Right. And you also have to kind of balance. Am I like just high on the fanship? Like, is the thing that I'm interested in? Or is it like the people who like the thing that I'm interested in?
Right. And what we're concerned about in the social identity aspect is kind of that, I mean, really it is both.
It is both.
But not just like when we're talking about like normative influence, it's probably going to be the group that's kind of influencing and shaping some of those behaviors. But then like towards the marketing side of things, if you're just really in it for the thing or that one personality or that one, that's also going to influence you in a number of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
These kind of distinct aspects of identity.
And I think that moves us very seamlessly on to kind of this idea of identity fragmentation for these identity groups. One of the things that's pretty unique, I would say, and I may be, you know, proven wrong, leave a comment, yell at me about it, is that we're seeing this fracturing of identity groups in a way that we haven't necessarily seen before. And so you get, like, you start with these, like, big identity groups. So we'll run with fans for a second before I get spicy. Like the anime fandom, for example. Like, you're not really an anime fan. Like, you are a mundane life drama anime fan. You are a, you know, RPG style anime fan. You're,
if
like...
if you're older, you're probably a mecha anime fan.
Right, exactly. I'm into space animes. And for the record, I'm into Catholic themed animes. That's my jam.
I'm an old school. If I were to fit into any of those categories after looking at all that data and all that research, I would probably find myself into like the mecha.
Yeah.
Or mine would definitely fans. Yeah.
Mine would definitely be like that spiritual demonology fantasy group.
Another really good example of this is again, modern Star Wars fans.
Mm-hmm.
Because no one's just a Star Wars fan anymore. It's you're either like you're or if you're under that, you then have to kind of pick your sub community.
Right.
Are you a original trilogy? Are you a prequel trilogy? Or are you a sequel trilogy fan? And those fans aren't getting a lot of love.
No, none of those fans get along.
But in about 10 years, when those kids who grew up with the three new movies are older, just like those kids who grew up with the prequel trilogies are now like becoming adults and are well into their adulthood and are like, no, but we really liked Attack of the Clones.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're getting along the sequel or the original and I think sequel or prequel trilogies are getting along a little better now, but they're fractured. And then you have people who, you know, again, are a fan of the comics. Maybe they're or their biggest community is, or you have these like sub communities built up online just around the Clone Wars series, the Rebels mm-hmm. series, the Mandalorian, the new big popular series. And so you've got people who are clustering around that. There's some overlap.
Mm-hmm.
But
there's definitely a fracturing.
Yeah.
I will say I went back and watched the prequel the other day, not the other day, the other month. I don't know what days are. I don't know what time is. I didn't hate them.
No.
Like I remembered. Like, they had some pretty good, like, social commentary in them. I was like, okay, no, this isn't bad.
You have to invest eight seasons now, but Clone Wars is really good. Rebels is pretty good once you get past, like, the first season, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Mandalorian's great. Like, I mean, I'm a Star Wars fan, but I had like the original trilogy on VHS. I'm not old enough to have seen them in the theaters.
Mm-hmm, same.
But I grew up with them and was super excited when the prequel trilogy came out.
Did you have that VHS pack where it was like all three of them and each one was like a side slice of like Vader or a clone
yes.
trooper? I think like C-3PO.
Yes.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. I had a couple of other ones too, because like they put up the special editions. But anyway, digressing about Star Wars again.
It's hard not to. We're white dudes. We're the ideal consumer demographic until recently.
Yeah. So.
So there is an identity fracturing going on. I've heard it called the balkanization of identity. I've heard it called the deconstruction of identity. There's a couple sociological high theories about this. One of the mainline, or I guess the founding text for this, would be a book called Capitalism and Schizophrenia by Deleuze. Came out in 1977, French postmodernist, like all the good works are. And pretty much the argument is that, you know, as we progress through capitalism, that things get more individual, we start losing our group attachments. And so a part of that process is the fragmenting of our group identities. And so you get to a point where now you have like a laundry list of 12 things you identify with, as opposed to like two or three. And those two or three identities that you used to people used to identify with are breaking down further. And so one of the, because this is, you know, my area that I'm particularly interested in, is watching sexual orientation identities break down. If you go back to some Foucault, we used to not have sexual identity or orientation labels or groups at all. They weren't really distinct groups or identities until like the mid 1800s. And then we get a binary of, you know, heterosexual and homosexual. Well, actually, we just get homosexual. The straights didn't even identify themselves. They were default. And then we start to get homosexual, and then bisexual comes into the mix. And then we get Kinsey, where he splits us all up into seven different identity points. So you're a Kinsey 2, you're a Kinsey 4, a Kinsey 6. And then as we move on into our post-Tumblr era, we have multiple ways that people are identifying with their sexual orientation, whether that be pansexual, demisexual, asexual. And so now there's just countless, like I just gave you like the, you know, the ones that people have heard about mostly. But if you get on some of these Tumblr lists, there's stuff, there's like a lot of made up Greek words to identify different experiences of sexuality, to the point where it's kind of being LGBT, I guess, is no longer the like solid umbrella that it once was, that there's so many distinct groups, and with so many distinct groups all vying to be the exemplar of the queer community. Yeah. There's lots of tension.
I was reading this line from our little handout here, and it was making me think about this, because I'm wondering if this, in part, maybe speculate that this is part of a byproduct of maybe one of two things. On one hand, I'm thinking it's identity development. It's self-identity development.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to understand who you are. You're 13 to 25. And you're trying to figure out who you are. And so there's a lot of self-exploration during that age category. There's a lot of trying to understand. I could probably think that if I were maybe 10 years younger and grew up kind of during that age range in like a Tumblr setting or a Twitter was more prominent. I mean, I was mid to late 20s in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of already past that point of like trying to figure out who I am and who I wanted to be, even though it still took a couple more years. That what about, you know, I'm trying to figure this out. I'm on these communities. I'm involved in these communities. And someone says like, hey, I've come up with this term. And you go, you know, that actually kind of explains what I've been thinking about myself.
Right.
Or maybe that's at least a pretty good modifier, or a pretty good, not modifier, identifier for how I would define myself. And then if enough people eventually kind of pick up that identifier, it becomes something broader. So how we can see this shift between like, if straight is the default, and then you have people who aren't straight being identified as homosexual, and then, you know, other people come along and say, but what if I'm attracted to both?
Mm-hmm.
And then Kinsey comes along and makes it a little more complex. Or then later on, you have someone who says, like, I've never really felt sexual attraction towards anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And then so like, well, like, we've got these different variations in terms. Well, why don't I tack on an A in front of it to mean like non? And that's what I'll call myself. And then other people, you know, it's about half to 1%. And a lot of the research, I mean, though, that can be skewed because of stigma. But let's say there's 1% of the population who says that they're asexual. Like, that's still a fair number of people.
And, yeah.
And, you know, you have someone who's maybe never felt that way, but the default identity has always been attraction to one or attraction to the other. And you finally get someone to say, well, hey, I've never had this. And we have the internet, which allows us to actually run into people like this.
Mm-hmm.
In our hometown, we may have been that 1%.
Right.
So we've got that on one side, that this is this sort of natural byproduct of like more people being able to communicate with one another about trying to understand their own identities. especially when you're younger. The other side makes me wonder if, and so this is this quote from Riker, Spears, and Haslam, 2010. Categorization in particular stimulus context is constructed by the perceiver's prior expectations, goals, and theories, many of which derive from their group membership and group encounters. And the way I think about this is that you are also interacting with the default and
the older established.
The older established. And you are not part of that. Or you right. don't feel that you fit in part of that. And maybe you have a group of people who also share that same thing with you. And while you wouldn't normally see it as this such a separate identity, it is forced upon you.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of older established non-your group members say, you are not like us, you are them. And you go, well, if we're them, here's our label now. This is what mm-hmm. we're going to be called. Or they call you that, and you adopt that label. And we could probably see that pretty heavily in a lot of, I mean, to the point where you go back to even during Kinsey's time, this not only stigmatization of non-straight lifestyle, but a direct implication of it as being a mental health issue in the DSM.
Mm-hmm.
And you're basically told, nope, you're a part of this other group. There's something wrong with that. But over time, you know, you have to come together for solidarity. You have to come together as part of this group. And so it kind of creates this divide when we should probably be thinking of ourselves in a much higher salient category, but the nature of the way that these groups are treated kind of causes mm-hmm. that break. Or what a lot of people with like bisexual identity talk about with like bi erasure, where they mm-hmm. have trouble with both the straight community because they have attraction to the same sex, but they also have issues with some members in the lesbian and gay community because they're not completely attracted to one side. And so
mm-hmm.
they may not fit in, or in some cases be seen as this other, this different group, because they can blend in better with the default.
And there is a turbulent history with that. In I believe it's Connecticut, there's a pride parade in the 80s. It used to just be the L&G parade for lesbian and gays, and the bisexuals wanted to join in, to which the response was, why are you, we don't care what happens in the bedroom, but this is a romantic, like, love oriented parade. We don't need you to be bringing your sexuality into this.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
We're just trying to get married. Wow. You can sleep with whoever you want to, but don't bring your sexuality into this.
Which, I mean, you could have probably gone back 30 years and probably heard the same thing from any other parade.
Yep. No. So there's definitely like wow. tension there. And I will say we're in a different era, too, with, you know, we talk about the algorithms a lot. But, you know, the algorithm ensures that you find that group of people and then sticks you to that group of people and then markets to you all collectively. So, you know, if you're starting to like, oh, maybe I don't fit into here, or maybe I looked up this term, or maybe I did this thing, you're going to like get funneled into that group. And then that's all your feed's going to be. Like right now, I made the mistake of looking up the no porn movement, where people are trying to get rid of their quote unquote porn addictions. Okay. And I say quote unquote because that's a contested term within the yeah. clinical psychology field. Now all my Reddit feed is just people talking about dealing with their porn addiction, like it's alcoholism. And so the algorithm thinks that I have a porn addiction right now. So, you know, you make one move in the Google search, and then all of a sudden you are like tied to a community of people.
And I wonder too if part of that, especially with that need, like, I mean, we'll eventually have a broader discussion about outrage culture and the algorithm and things like that, but that also helps to feed in to these multiple identities too, because you're being stigmatized for these identities that are personal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're part of self-reflection. If you want to identify as anything, sure. Like, that's not really going to hurt anyone, and that's generally not going to I mean, like, there are aspects that I don't, I've tried to understand with the furry research in terms of, like, other kin whatnot, and I don't think that way. I will never get it. And, but also, like, I'm not gonna go make a 2-hour YouTube video on why this is all a made-up thing, and these people are, like, mentally disturbed or something like that, because it's an aspect of, like, I can look at it in both ways. On one hand, it's an aspect of, like, self-identity and exploration and someone trying to understand something about themselves or coming to some sort of conclusion about themselves that ties into a mix of both the communities that they belong to, but also, like, personal, like, self-identity aspects of this. And you go online, you can find communities that also share these views, and so you can develop those aspects of social identity with it, so there can be some overlap there. But also, on the other side, like, because people are making videos on it, because people are stigmatizing it, because people are making it a much bigger deal than it actually is, it's going to create that sense of, like, well, I need to hold on to this. And it's us versus them. Mm-hmm. They're fighting against me. They're fighting against us. And the reality is that a lot of people would probably just be like, you do you. I'm going to go about my
But day. Then it kind of goes back. But it goes back to the algorithm, too, because YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, they will profit off of that call-out video on the other kin, because that call-out video on the other kin is the tag. So anybody who's searched that, a part of that, involved in that tag, is going to see that video, and then they themselves are going to get upset, to which will ensue a response level of videos, because their group was attacked, obviously, to which the group that did the attack the first time is going to have to respond, and then get all, what do they call it, engagement, user engagement. And that is fantastic for all those advertisers.
And that just further feeds this priming of those aspects of group identity. My group is being attacked, so I'm going to respond, or we're going to band together, or I'm going to double down. This is a good segue into some identity uncertainty. So Michael Hogg and some of his colleagues have worked on this concept called identity uncertainty theory. And it essentially says, kind of in short, that when our identity is called into question, when the future of our identity or aspects of our identity are uncertain, it creates dissonance, negative emotions. And we have two ways in which to deal with it. And actually, when it comes to identity, we have a number of different ways that we engage with it. I'll go through this because I love these reaction to negative or threatened identities that's in this little handout. If your group is low status but has high permeability, so I'm part of, let's say, a stigmatized anime community.
Right. I watch Attack on Titan. I don't. I don't. Don't come for me. I do not watch that show.
No, actually, the most disliked anime community within the anime community is Sword Art Online.
Oh, it is, isn't it? I forgot.
Yeah, that is at least that's what the data from the last, like, 8 years says. And again, like, don't come at us, Sword Art Online fans. It's a very popular anime, and there's a lot of, like, people in the anime fandom who are like, this is popular, we don't like it, these people are annoying. And that's kind of where a lot of it comes from. It's gatekeeping, elitism. It's not you do you, it's these people are young fans, and maybe they haven't, you know, they're entering the fandom at an early age, or they think this is something easier to be exposed to. So
it's pretty easy to drop your status there. Like, I don't watch Sword. I'm not a fan of Sword Art Online. Actually, what are you talking about?
Growing up in, like, the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, as a early 90s when I first started getting into anime, as an anime fan, like, you were only limited to, like, some of the quasi, I'm not sure if this is regular anime or porn, at the local blockbuster. Like, that was all you got exposed to, because you didn't have the internet.
Right.
But
then you can make a distinction.
Right. But if there's this low status, I mean, there may be a low status group, so you're watching cartoons. but there's high permeability. No one has to know I'm an anime fan. I could bounce out of that group in any. And so what you see in this is individual mobility. So
mm-hmm.
You leave the group. Or you hide the group. You try to distance yourself from the group in any way.
And it's pretty easy too. You're not going to have like internalized shame usually from hiding this kind of group.
Yeah, and especially like nowadays where it doesn't matter if the group is stigmatized, if it's got high permeability, you can easily not express your membership in the group, but you can still engage with them a lot. And so mm-hmm. you can still get all the benefits of group belongingness with these things that you are really interested in, even if like your parents don't get it or your parents disapprove of it.
Or your friends don't, and you're just doing it ironically for the lulz.
Yeah. And we see some of that. So then we have things like low status, low permeability, but with these other two aspects, stability and legitimacy. And so basically what this means is that you have this low status group that you can't get out of, but you're highly legitimate. And so you are definitely identified as part of this group. You cannot like easily, like you are an established group. And then high stability, where it's really hard to kind of change the nature of the group.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, you get things like creativity, where you compare on a different dimension. So this would be a good example of like someone's on Twitter complaining about white people or men.
Okay.
This isn't really a low status group. This is actually a high status group.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got low permeability. And so what ends up if you're...
And I mean, depending on what corner of the internet you're in, being a man could be a low status group. Like if I'm on like r/gendercritical, yeah. I'm a low status group.
but it is a group that is highly stable for the most part. It's pretty easy to identify. Like, I mean, if you're looking at someone like me, I have a beard. I could shave my beard, but I'm still gonna demonstrate a lot of stereotypically masculine traits. Or at least have a lot of stereotypically masculine features.
And so, if you're on r/gendercritical, you're not going to be able to alter out of your group anyway.
And so what happens in those cases is you get things like social creativity, where you try to compare yourself on different dimensions. So like, I'm not one of those guys, or I'm not going to base myself on X. I'm going to look at Y instead. Y is a positive thing. X is not.
I'm a nice guy.
Or
I'm a gay guy.
Or things like change the value of an attribute, so viewing something as very positive and distinct as opposed to being negative. So, you know, maybe if I kind of switch the way that I view it, or maybe try to argue otherwise. And then we could just change the comparison group. I just remind mm-hmm. people of groups that are worse than me, or worse than the groups mm-hmm. that I belong to. Like, yeah, but we're not those other guys over there. They're even mm-hmm. worse. And so it helps to kind of create that. Now, on the other hand, is what happens if you have a group that's low status, low permeability, low legitimacy, and stability. So they're not a socially powerful group, but it's also a group that you can't get out of. Want to help to understand why people protest, why there's pushback. If there's this perceived low legitimacy, like low power within your group, like, so we're talking about white politician complaining about something, they're a highly legitimate, highly stable. They have a lot of stability in their lives. Their group has a lot of stability potentially. They're very legitimate in terms of their power structure, and so they're going to use these other methods, social creativity and whatnot. Whereas for a group that is low in legitimacy, low in its stability, like its social stability, we tend to see social competition kick in.
Mm-hmm.
They fight because you're backed into a corner. You have no other recourse. You can't leave your group, so you have to fight for your group.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see this in a number of different ways with groups that are stigmatized or where stigma looks in, or if we want to use aspects of social identity to look at why people mobilize for a number of different things. You can argue that a lot of the people in, let's say, the Occupy Wall Street movement may belong to groups that could have high status, that could have some legitimacy, but these are predominantly not rich people. And so if you're not rich, you got low on all four of these.
Yep. You may have some social capital, but if you don't have actual capital, it doesn't do you much good.
And it's really hard. Like, there's not a lot of permeability if you're poor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could take time, and some people can scrape themselves out, but the data tends to show...
Pull yourself up from your bootstraps.
But the data tends to show it's not nearly as common as we like to think it is. We are not actually a nation of embarrassed millionaires. We're like, I'm going to be a millionaire one day. Like, no. No.
We're actually at Gilded Age levels right now, so there's more people who are poor than aren't. So it's a pretty large group.
And so they have less power within the structure and low stability. Like, things can change for them much more rapidly than someone else. They're a much less stable group for a lot of different reasons. And so what do? They fight back. So this one is perception of stability is whether or not there are cognitive alternatives. I'm going to add that to clarify it, because I think I was making a little...
Mm-hmm.
A little more wobbly than it actually was, but
So if I can realistically switch groups, or not switch groups, but like have an alternative, like if there's a way for me to escape the situation,
yeah,
and still identify,
and we do that in a number of different ways. We escape through media, mm-hmm. we escape through other things.
If you're in a low status, low permeability group, but you have money, there's some really rich furries that are having no problems.
Yeah. Doesn't matter if you're in a low status group.
Mm-hmm.
Stigma's low. And so you find those other things, the social creativity, you change the value of the attribute, or you change your comparison group. Like, mm-hmm. you go and do this, but like, that stigma just washes off your back, because it's not, you got other things. You got money. Like,
are the poor saying something? I can't make it out.
but what happens in these situations, and what happens when these situations are a little more nebulous, when they're a little more iffy or uncertain, especially in times of, let's say, economic concern, where things mm-hmm. become more uncertain? And we have, especially when there's an us versus them dynamic, what happens in terms of things like political change? So when there's the sudden change in political leadership, or when kind of a certainty of like, my guy's gonna win, suddenly breaks down,
mm-hmm. there's
this uncertainty that builds up, or the future of my group is prime. And actually, there's plenty of that if we look at modern political propaganda of the great erasure and the great replacement.
The great replacement, yeah.
Where this idea of your group is going to be erased because we are becoming a more ethnically diverse society. And that if there are no true 100% white people, then it creates this level of uncertainty.
Skyrim is for the Nords.
Exactly. Or, again, any of that. So when uncertainty builds up, we're kind of given two options. We can either kind of accept it and maybe move out of that group. And usually this is going to happen with the low identifiers, or maybe even some of the average identifiers, where they're just like, I got other groups I can go to.
Mm-hmm.
Using our fan community analogy, we can say, I've got these other groups that I can go to. I've got other things that I'm interested in. This show ends. Hey, this other one's going to begin. Those Star Wars fans who, when the sequel trilogy came out, went, I didn't like these, but hey, I got all these other Star Wars movies. I got this other show. I got the comic books. I can go watch Star Trek. I can go watch anime. I got all this other. I go play video games. I don't have to pay attention to Star Wars. Like, I've got other things.
Into football.
Right. But those high identifiers, those individuals who might view that there's going to be less stability, there's going to be less options, alternatives, less permeability. This is my group. Can't leave my group. and this is more, I guess, more salient, more easy to identify within something like the political sphere, because, I mean, there are plenty of people who identify as not Republican and not Democrat. There are plenty of people who identify as independents or libertarians or the Green Party or the rent is too damn high party or whatever fractured.
Or they just don't identify at all.
Yes. And while a lot of Americans don't go out and vote, many of those people who do still go out and vote for either Republican or Democrat. Because there's not a lot of cognitive alternatives. You can identify with whatever you want, but the reality of their situation is that there are two major parties that are kind of running the show. And so if you're, and it's even harder if you are one of those party members. If you are
right.
of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party and something happens, your guy loses, maybe someone who you didn't expect to get into the White House gets into the White House. And if you think I'm going to talk about what I'm talking about, I'm going to talk about 2008 first.
I mean, this happens every election. Come on now. Yeah. Except for maybe 2012. That one was pretty solid.
Well, I mean, 2008 was a bit of a landslide. I mean, Obama won by pretty big numbers. And it wasn't very close, at least in the grand scheme of like how some elections have gone recently. But this idea of, we saw like the rise of groups like the Tea Party, which it turns out were not a homegrown group, were a completely astroturf group funded by vested interests. But like a group like that is going to be much easier to create when you can build that uncertainty. When you can say like, hey, that guy's not like you. And if we don't do something about it, you're never going to see someone like you in the White House ever again. Or your neighbors aren't going to be like you. And they're priming those levels of uncertainty. And what happens for those high identifiers, for those long-term, long-standing Republicans who kind of go down that line, well, they have a choice. They either maybe join the Libertarians, they maybe try to find some other niche alternative if they can. So, you know, if they've got money, they're probably not too concerned about it. If they've got some other aspect of permeability, they can go find something else. But if there's not that perception there, identity uncertainty theory says that they're going to become more extreme. That they're going to keep moving further and further to extreme variations of their norms.
Because the in-group gets more powerful. That inner circle does.
Right. And they're going to solidify, and they're going to come out, and we're going to call it economic anxiety in 8 years. And maybe there is some economic anxiety there because they're being primed by propaganda, for lack of a better word. They're being primed to kind of view the future of their own jobs, the future of their own communities, the future of their own country as being uncertain.
I mean, really, we're all under economic anxiety. Just not all of us are drinking the tea.
Well... And a lot of us are under economic anxiety because the economy isn't working like it should for the average person. It's just the difference of why. And so if that why is a threat to your identity group, as let's say a white male, as opposed to maybe other richer white men like Jeff Bezos having more money than he'll ever be able to spend. Ever. That's something like that. But like, if you can point to that, it kind of builds up that level of uncertainty. It builds up that level of dissonance, and people are more likely to go extreme. And we actually see this in the Pew data that was collected during the Obama presidency. You know, everyone was talking about how there's this greater and greater and greater political divide. And then you look at all the research data on how people identify in terms of their politics and how that has changed. People in the center and people on the left did not change all that much during the Obama presidency. They stayed pretty stable. The difference was a further shift to the right. And we see that, and that may be a byproduct. I mean, there's, I think, a good hypothetical argument for that there, that may be a byproduct tied out of these these systems in place that help feed that uncertainty. And it's been going on long before Obama was president. Like, it goes back.
Oh yeah.
But like, one of the things that I've been wondering is whether or not, you know, we see this in, let's say, a post-Trump presidency or a post-Bernie loss,
mm-hmm.
a dual post-Bernie loss in 16 and 20, of hardcore supporters basically saying, like, all right, do I find a different identity? Do I move into this group, or do I double down and maybe mm-hmm. shift a little further left?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if we'll know this until maybe another couple of years of Pew data, like, actually
collecting this.
But it would be interesting to see if we are seeing more of a shift, or maybe it's just a perceptual thing. Maybe it's just tied into that narrative that we are moving further and further apart, and there's this bigger and bigger divide, because that also helps further that uncertainty and that us versus them and that fracturing, because we're not Americans. Republicans or Democrats, we're left or right.
Mm-hmm.
It helps to further that further fracturing ultimately reduces higher level salience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's going to be interesting to see. Like, because honestly, I think the proportions, it'll be, yeah. Because, like, if we go off of kind of just, you know, who took over after Trump, you know, there was very much a Make America Great Against, like, remix going on. Like, we went back into the 90s.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, like, we stopped in the 90s on our way back to the 50s with Trump.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for a lot of older, more wealthy people who were doing all right in the 90s, that makes sense that we would stop there.
I mean, even you can argue for a lot of people, I would say in my generation, these kind of, like, very, like, old in millennials, very young Gen Xers. I'm sort of in the middle there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we also, like, we were kids in the 90s. And so we can probably remember a time where things were pretty, I mean, when you're a kid, things are pretty stable. You don't really understand
right. The
nuances of the political state of the world. And so, yeah, that need to kind of, like, stop there.
Mm-hmm. And, no, that was definitely, like, for like people who were kids then, that's like a warm and fuzzy time. For people who are older, that was like, oh hey, maybe this neoliberal thing's gonna work out. Bill Clinton's got it covered.
Yeah.
And we even chose someone who was, you know, in his heyday at the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll see. Like, I wonder if I think the thing that's the more interesting question that will kind of give us an idea into this is watching the issues with Andrew Cuomo in New York right now, because we're starting to see the formation of a Cuomo base that looks very Trumpian in the midst of all of this.
Yeah, almost like, I don't know, you call Cuomo neoliberal?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Maybe like an extreme...
All of our... All of our politicians are neoliberal. That's the dominant ideology.
The vast majority, yeah. but like kind of like an extreme neoliberal base.
Yeah, no, he's very much that 90s, like, Democrat.
What would be probably considered today in America, like, an uber-centrist?
Uber-centrist, Republican light. So, you know, I wonder if we're shifting, if, like, the Democrat base is shift, actually, you know, if they're actually shifting right as well to compensate for the Overton window shift for Trump.
And, I mean, and that becomes difficult if you've only got two parties.
Right. Because yeah. So, that'll be kind of interesting. We'll see what happens to the ex-Bernie people, like... Clearly, their hatred of Trump outweighed their hatred of Biden.
Yeah. There were a lot of Republicans, I think, too, but there was also a lot of Republicans who didn't mm-hmm. vote in 2016 who also voted in 2020. So it's really interesting to see, like, where some of that's going to go. I mean, not, like, in a good way.
Oh, no, I'm not looking forward to any of this.
But it also reminds me, too, like, so part of how this kind of ties into where we're getting into with uncertainty and whatnot is that this self-categorization in part helps to drive this. It helps to drive aspects of uncertainty. And the more you fracture, the more you kind of distill yourself down to the most like minute identity, or, you know, if we're talking about, let's say, like the Arizona Democratic Party, who like they all walked out when all the progressives won, where they basically said like, we're not like you, we're leaving, like that further like fractures these distinctions.
Was that Arizona or Nevada?
Nevada.
Yeah.
And so
I think a good example of this is also during the last election, you had the fine, we'll vote for Biden people versus the vote blue no matter who, vote blue up and down the ballot, don't do anything that's not blue.
Yeah, and we kind of saw how that played out, because like Biden won by really large margins, but other Democratic politicians did not. And so, but like part of that too, like that divide, it ultimately benefits groups like kind of your mainstream Republicans, your mainstream Democrats. It benefits a lot of the news organizations. It benefits a lot of social media platforms, that if we have these bigger and bigger breaks, categorically speaking, and that if we're thinking of ourselves saliently as these little bubbles, these little groups, because that ultimately helps the algorithm. Not really broad. Mm-hmm. We're very narrow. So it helps to kind of narrow down what we're watching, narrow down content. We become these smaller and smaller communities. It ultimately kind of wedges a lot of us apart. And that social identity would kind of help explain why that ultimately would see some shifts and why that ultimately is maybe not the best way to go. I'm not saying like come together with a bunch of terrible people, but
right. We can. But you have to have a shared, like, yeah, you have to share some sort of, like, if you want a political movement to succeed, you need to, like, make a little bit of, like, an analysis of, like, construction versus essential. Like, right. We're all the same to a point, and that point is the political movement. I think the feminism is a great example of this. Like, they were highly essential, you know, wave one, wave two, wave three, and then the internet got to them. And more people start being heard, which I think is absolutely great. But rather than accommodating all of that, they got segmented. And now you have several different camps of feminism all fighting each other and different things. Fighting each other and also for different things. So they're no longer really as powerful of a movement as, say, waves one, two, and three were, because women are women.
And there's... what we see with, like, so it's like how this ties into social identity is that, so the higher your salient identity, the more inclusive you kind of become. And so at the most high level, the highest level we could have right now would probably be human. We are all, doesn't matter, we're all human, we're all part of the same species. It doesn't matter what country we're from, it doesn't matter what subgroup we're in, we are all here on this planet together. But we don't typically think of ourselves as human. Some people do, but it's kind of a rarity in the grand scheme of things. Usually we're thinking of ourselves based on maybe country of origin. So we have a lot of people who think of themselves as American or citizen versus immigrant.
Or state.
By state. So New Mexican, we're a Texan, we're, you know, Nebraskan, a citizen of Maine. I'm going to say a Mainian.
A Mainite.
We're gonna get canceled by Maine in this one.
Stephen King's gonna come for us.
But like we have these lower level identities, and then you start splitting that up further. So, you know, you could say like under the American umbrella, we could have white, black, Hispanic, Asian, these subcategories of American. Sometimes that goes away. We have sort of aspects of perceived threat. So post 9/11, there were a lot of groups that wouldn't have normally been as, you know,
buddy buddy,
got pretty buddy buddy against this sort of other people suffered for that. And then you could break that down even further. And so what happens is if you have, let's say, under American, you have these two political parties. And then these two political parties are very fractured. It just kind of depends on who's going to fall in line versus who's going to stay fractured. And it benefits one group over the other if the other group is very fractured. There's that that great quote, Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. And I was thinking about this and listening to someone talk about like the aspect of purity test. And that's part of, I think, what's coming out of a lot of these fractures and a lot of these different subgroups. So instead of accommodating, well, you violate the purity test. You can't be grabbed. Mm-hmm. And there's this difference between like what might be happening and why we might see some more success is that the kind of the purity test on the right now is mostly like, just do you agree with us? And if you say yes and will let us do our thing, you are part of our group. That is the only purity test you need to do, is you need to just keep doing whatever we're doing. You need to
just
keep
vote us. Red.
That's it. We don't care, but also like you're gonna buy into.
Are you a atheist libertarian who lives in a bunker? You vote red? Cool. Are you like a hippie homeschool mom?
As long as you fall in line. Now, yep. that could be detrimental, because you could have some people who do have to shift aspect of their views if they want to become politicians. So you'd have people who might be more open, but hey, they got to fall in line. And so that means like, I'm not going to like these groups, and I'm going to talk bad about these groups, and I might say this really offensive stuff, because that's what's getting me clicks on Twitter. But the other side of this, if the purity test is like, you have to be a part of
subgroup.
By subgroup, and you have a bunch of subgroups with very different, you know, views of that, it can create more of a divide. And that ultimately doesn't benefit that group. It benefits the other. It benefits the group that falls in line. And that, you know, and again, we're not going to say, like, go out and, like, vote against your interest. But
that's not really, can't not vote against your interest at this point.
Right. Because, you know, we're not looking at something like ranked voting or something like that.
Right.
But the identity of the situation is like part of that identity plays a role in that. And the norms of the group, that norms of, I mean, truly, when we get down to the basis of what it means to be a liberal or a conservative, it's tradition versus change in its most philosophical sense. And maybe in part why we see this. Like, one group's like, no, we got to change things. We got to like shake things up, which means that it's going to be very hard to come together and all agree on something, because you've got these varying views of wanting to see different social shifts, versus a group that's like, I just want some stability. I don't care if it hurts these other people. I just want to be stable. I just want things to stay the way they are. I don't want to have things maybe more complex, or maybe there's something else. Maybe there's a particular issue that you want to stay the same. And there's this perception. In some cases, it's a perception. In some cases, it is reality that this other group wants to change that.
I mean, even on the liberal side, you want change. That may or may not hurt people.
Right.
Like, it's kind of the idea of like, okay, you care about global warming. Well, you know, the cost of that, of cutting down emissions, is going to be screwing over a lot of working people who work in the oil and gas field, because that's the only job in their town that they can have. So, you know, is long-term global emissions more important than individuals with jobs?
I mean, there are ways to,
you know, you gotta, you know, whether you're fighting for tradition or change, you've still got to make that calculation. And typically, whoever gets the butt end of that on either side is on the other side.
Yeah. So, but yeah, like these are aspects of identity. Again, these groups that you belong to, and again, some of them, I mean, we can argue to some of this extent, isn't all choice. Some of it is where you're born. It's definitely a part of that, how much you've been exposed to, whether or not you're able to engage with people outside of your group, how homogenous is the group that you grow up in. And so if you're growing up in a small town, like, you're going to be influenced by a much more different group of people than if you grow up in the middle of a city. And even if you grow up in part A of the city versus part B of the city, or, you know, on uptown versus downtown, like, these are going to change a lot of aspects about kind of how you view yourself and the groups that you belong to and everything that goes into that.
And like, and when you were born makes a big difference too. Like you just said, there's a big difference between older millennials and up and younger millennials and down in terms of political conceptualization.
Yeah, it's like, I will say, as the kind of older millennial, younger Gen Xer, like, my political understanding and a lot of things that maybe I hold now are very different than they were when I was 15, 20, 25, mm-hmm. maybe even an extent 30. And, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of that has changed and evolved over time, but I've also been privileged to an degree to be able to pay attention to a lot of this stuff over the last maybe 10 mm-hmm. years, and to engage with it a little more, and to read into it a little more, and to try to understand it a little more, as opposed to just kind of going along with the people around me.
Mm-hmm. Or have it actively happening to you.
Yes, yeah, that as well, which definitely changes how I may view it. And then that's also going to change how I perceive it, and change how I internalize it, and change what I kind of agree and maybe disagree with based on a number of different factors tied to my identity as mm-hmm. X or Y. Well, I think we're good to move into our end game.
Yes, no, you get some social psychologists talking about social identity, we're going to ramble for a hot minute.
We're going to talk about politics, sex, and actually, I don't think we talked about religion in this one. So we talked about politics and sex. So,
yeah, we did. We almost hit all three.
Yeah, two of the three things you're not supposed to talk about around the dinner table. but hey, one more spicy thing. Let's talk about our bias of the week.
Woohoo!
So, our bias of the week is stereotyping.
Of course it is. Why wouldn't it be?
I mean, it's just kind of perfect. We're talking about identity, aspects of prototypicality, like the prototypes of identity. I didn't get to mention my favorite word in identity research, entitativity.
Entitativity?
It's just so much fun to say. But how alike your group members are, the more entitative your group is, the more alike everyone is. And so the more likely you are to identify if you fit that group.
Mm-hmm.
But all of these things, like the prototypes, the exemplars help to set them, all influence stereotypes.
Yep.
And stereotypes also influence those things.
Mm-hmm.
Even for the groups that we belong to that are stigmatized. They can influence how we might act or behave, or in some cases, if we talk about like stereotype threat, how we might avoid certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So, quick definition, believing unfairly and incorrectly that all members of a group with a particular characteristic are the same. So basically holding a similarities exist solely because of membership in a group, not personal differences.
So it's basically out-group homogeny.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or we have in-group heterogeneity, where because we know more people in our in-group, we know the diversity that exists within our in-group. And so we can say, yep, it's very diverse. We have a lot of different people here. You know, this person over there is like this, and that person is like this, and this person is like this. And yeah, there's probably some bad people because of just the law of
large numbers. There's bad apples in every barrel.
You give me a large enough group of people, I'll find you any demographic you want. But this is by saying, no, it's everyone. It's across the board. There are no exceptions. And usually, again, this is not like a conscious thing. There's some people who take this consciously. But this is not sort of a conscious thing. This is something that's based on where you grow up, what you listen to, what your parents say, what your peers say, what your textbooks say, what the media you watch portrays. It's tied to just kind of what becomes your perception of these groups.
Mm-hmm. And often these stereotypes do become archetypes as well, if they're long-standing enough. So you get lots of like sub-archetypes within different groups that people tend to be aware of. Oftentimes, like, you get a lot of like the reclaiming research and discourse. So, you know, for gay men, you know, purposely going out and doing drag, or purposely being more effeminate, or purposely dressing more outside of a gender norm is kind of a way to reclaim that stereotype and find power in it is also something that happens within the group. So it is also a two-way street too.
Yeah, and then some of these are you know, maybe based in some reality, but that reality is based on a social situation. So like the social environment makes it to where one group is more likely to be like this or in this particular situation. And so when outsiders look at that, they go, oh, they're all like this. probably the best example from a historical standpoint is Jewish people involved in money. Because if you go back to early, I mean, we're talking like early medieval, pre-medieval Europe, there were laws in place and that there were legal standings and religious standings where Christians could not lend money with interest to other Christians. And so there was no money to be made in money lending. But if you were Jewish, you could run a bank. And actually, at the time, it was also very difficult if you were non-Christian to own land. And so, like, ironically, you couldn't own the land to become a farmer or a blacksmith or, ironically, a carpenter if you were Jewish. You instead had to maybe rent a place. But one place, like you don't, you could rent another place if you got kicked out and still like lend money to people, and offer people loans and provide interest with that, which is not something that any other group can make. And it was a way to make money to pass that job on to your kids, as most families did at the time. You typically apprenticed with something that was sort of tied to either what your family did or someone else in town, and so. Yeah, and so there was this like historical antecedent that led to this likelihood that more people of a particular type were going to enter this particular profession, and thus it becomes stereotyped because it's kind of what you tend to see. It's what's more salient, it's what's more out in the open, and it really has nothing to do with that group, but the social environment in which that group exists.
Right, so because of anti-Semitism, Jews had to become bankers, and then they served a very crucial role in the society through banking,
which then when
that Christians couldn't do, and then that perpetuated out into a stereotype that we use against them.
Yes, for being greedy, grubby, whatever words you want to use. Yeah, which then, especially if you have again an under maybe represented group of the population with less political power, less power within a society, they're easier to point to as like, these people are the problem, these outsiders are the problem. Kind of in the same way of why we look at like migrant workers picking fruit and vegetables and how they're demonized for taking jobs, but like they're doing it because the average American's not going to go pick fruit for 20 cents an hour.
And yeah, because the company doesn't want to pay the average American to go do that.
Yeah, and it's not easy work. And so, like, these individuals are kind of doing it on the cheap, under the table, and thus, again, it's the social situation that they're being brought in to do this job, and then they're kind of returning home. And so it's not...
Because I'm sure there's plenty of poor Americans who would love to go pick fruit for their living, but the Americans are too expensive to hire for that kind of job.
Yeah, if you were going to pay them a living wage.
No.
Can't do that.
No, why on earth would we do that?
Yeah, the same thing with, too, like, poor people being lazy.
Mm-hmm.
Long-standing social history. There are plenty of people who would work.
Yep.
There are plenty of people who want to work, but they want to be able to, like, provide for themselves and their families. And so you can't do that on $7 an hour anymore.
Yep.
So on that note, I think that's a good stopping point.
Yes. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah. Goodbye.
Bye.